do something fun with the family. Come downtown and go to the auto show January 20th through the 22nd at the CHI Health Center. Get inside the newest cars, trucks, and SUVs and see some of the hottest electric cars like the Hyundai Ioniq 5. Race a NASCAR remote control car. See beautiful classic cars and visit the Subaru Pet Adoption. Free admission for veterans on Friday. Get out and go to the auto show January 20th through the 22nd. Find more at omahaautoshow.com.
If you look for it, every day has cause for celebration. Celebrate a friend for their promotion, baby wedding, life thing. Celebrate yourself for keeping the couch warm. It's no easy feat, especially if it's a big couch. Or maybe you just want to celebrate living in 2023, where you can get beer, wine, and spirits delivered from Drizzly in under 60 minutes without leaving said couch. So download the Drizzly app or go to drizzly.com. That's drizly.com and get your favorite drinks delivered today.
Welcome to the Rocks Back Pages podcast. I'm Barney Hoskins and I'm here with Mark Pringle.
Hi, Barney.
And Jasper Murison Bowie.
Hello, Barney.
For what I trust are all too obvious reasons, we are going to focus today on black lives and black music, paying particular attention to some of the artists who've taken a militant position against racism and persecution, while fully acknowledging that it's problematic for three white middle-class males to discuss this subject. We felt we had no option but to focus on it at what may be the most alarming moment yet of a deeply alarming presidency in the US. So today we're going to hear some audio with the late Gil Scott-Heron, and we're going to talk about Nina Simone, James Brown, Public Enemy, Kendrick Lamar and others, and also about the pioneering black quote-unquote rock critic Vernon Gibbs. Mark, let me start by asking you, you know, how big a part you think that music has played broadly in the history of civil rights and political protest, particularly in the US?
Well, I mean, historically, you can take it right back to the black churches in the South, particularly, where the voice of gospel music was as much a voice about not black power as such, but black fortitude in the face of brutality, slavery, prejudice, and so on. You know, I mean, how much African-American music was directly linked to the militancy that emerged in the 60s is slightly harder to judge. Certainly when I was growing up, the soul music I heard, outside of the occasional song like Change Is Gonna Come or whatever, very rarely did the music directly address the politics of the time. And my awareness of black militancy was not through music, if that makes any sense. I was very aware of things like the riots in Detroit and so on and so forth, 67 riots, 68. James Brown's I'm Set Loud, I'm Black and My Proud is one of the most overt of, let's say, what we call modern music. Nina Simone. But it's quite hard, actually, to describe the centrality of music to the Black Power movement. It's quite a complex sort of relationship.
Yeah, I listened to people like Nina Simone, and I remember hearing, you know, her famous song, Mississippi Goddamn, you know, when I was still a child. I don't know that I knew that it was directly related to the firebombing of the church in Alabama, but I kind of recognized that, you know, Nina was this very strong black presence. And I think from there, it sort of probably went into things like Curtis Mayfield, you know, who was such an extraordinarily sort of subtle commentator, wasn't he?
Yeah, no,
what was happening.
No, absolutely. I mean, in a sense, I've got to divide, let's say, my childhood, which is the 60s, and my sort of adolescence, which is the late 60s, early 70s. And it was in that process of getting older and becoming more aware of areas of black music that I hadn't really listened to. I mean, I grew up listening to things like the blues and so on and so forth, you know, and Motown. Then you move into the 70s, and there are certain artists, obviously Marvin Gaye, What's Going On, is an extraordinary thing. I mean, primarily in that case about the Vietnam War, but it's much broader issues of blackness, black in America. Curtis Mayfield, without a shadow of a doubt. And I became passionate. I absolutely fell in love with Curtis Mayfield. In a sense, you could talk about Curtis Mayfield goes back to what I first said about how the black church was a conduit for sort of political thought in the 19th and early 20th century. Is in a sense, Curtis is out of that tradition. you know, songs like People Get Ready are actually closer to sort of gospel songs.
And freedom songs as well. I mean, there's a big overlap between those two things. Mm-hmm. I mean, music that was part of the civil rights movement, like We Shall Overcome and This Little Light of Mine and that kind of thing. But sure, those kinds of songs that were sung, not necessarily always in a church context, but in a context of mass singing, whether it was in church or at a protest, I think is really important, as well as the as well as the popular music. And I think the two certainly fed into each other.
I think that's fair. I think that, even though certainly I wasn't aware of it at the time, but in retrospect, is that communal singing was a central part of the civil rights movement. It was a very, very key part of it, without a shadow of a doubt. I suppose the way we tended to receive it over here in the 60s was almost through the white voices doing it rather than the black voices, in a curious kind of way. But going from James Brown's Set Loud and Black and I'm Proud through to Public Enemy, for example, and certain aspects of hip-hop. I mean, you know, one of the things I've been listening to a lot the last few days is Fuck the Police by N.W.A. You know, it does what it says on the tin. You know,
definitely.
And they are responding to exactly the sort of thing that occurred over the last couple of weeks. The way in which black communities have been brutalized by the forces of law and order in the United States of America, and to a lesser extent in the UK, but nothing like to the same extent.
But important to note that here also.
Yeah, here, yeah, absolutely.
Absolutely, yeah.
But what's changed is the advent of the camera phone, that suddenly people are able to record events which took place all the time before. You know, remember the Detroit riots weren't a result of a death, I don't believe, but was certainly a result of heavy-handed policing outside a nightclub, was what kicked off the 67 Detroit riots, you know.
Yeah, and of course, pre-smartphone, the filming of the beating of Rodney King was absolutely critical.
Absolutely. No, I mean, in a sense, that was the first of the current history of police oppression of specifically the black community and to some extent the Latino community and so on and so forth, you know. And the advent of the phone means that suddenly stuff which has always happened, you know, just the police killing people for no reason, smartphones, CCTV, and suddenly these images are everywhere.
Yes.
And it's really changing the game.
I mean, look, it's not as if people of colour weren't being singled out, victimised, murdered by racist police officers before Trump. But the difference is now that America has a president that legitimises that racism and is almost unapologetically racist. And so, clearly this is why it has erupted, the George Floyd murder has ignited things in the way that it has, because it absolutely has been a pressure cooker waiting to blast.
Yeah, absolutely. And the way in which the police have responded to the demonstrations has been in itself extraordinary. That is, clearly they feel now given license by Donald Trump to be super aggressive towards people that they perceive as the enemy, which is people of color and anti-fascist protesters and so on and so forth. And there's a very interesting story today where policemen were allowing a white man to point a gun at the black demonstrators and arresting blacks who was just sitting on the pavement.
I mean, you only have to go back a few weeks to where we sort of laughed about the freedom protests by kind of alt-right groups wanting to be able to get their hair cut and stuff. And they were gun-toting protests. Yep. And gun-toting protesters that were allowed to march
into the Michigan State Legislature. You know, I mean, absolutely extraordinary.
It's just unbelievable. And these protests were peaceful until the police started firing rubber bullets and using tear gas.
You have a black unbelievable. You have a black CNN reporter who's arrested while a white CNN reporter is allowed to
go back. It's so transparent now, isn't it, Mark?
It's so transparent.
Mark, when did you become aware of, shall we say, you know, we talked about Mayfeld, we talked about James Brown. When did you become aware of the more sort of stridently militant voices of the Last Poets and, of course, Gil Scott-Heron?
Sure, much later. Much later. Yeah. Gil Scott-Heron I was kind of aware of pretty much at the time when he emerged. My awareness of him was slightly limited by the fact that I didn't love the sound of what he did. It was, you know, I mean, that's just one of those things. You know, I love music. If I don't love the music, I don't pay a lot of attention to it. But I was aware of him and what he was talking about. Last Poets, for me, was a very much a retrospective thing. I discovered them, you know, really quite late in life, actually.
Well, they weren't being played on Radio 1.
They were not being played on Radio 1.
Or Radio
The
Luxembourg.
Last Poets will not be radio broadcast. Yeah.
I mean, I still find them problematic because, I mean, whilst I think they sound fantastic, and it is now a sound I absolutely adore, they're incredibly misogynist, you know. I mean,
and homophobic, and homophobic. All kinds of things, sure, yeah, yeah, yeah.
But you know, they're also extraordinary, you know. Yeah, but I think probably it's hip hop, certain areas of hip hop, particularly like Public Enemy, as I said, that really kind of for me raised the game in terms of people who were really political and really addressing what they saw in the society that surrounded them.
Shall we talk just briefly about Gil Scott-Heron? Because we're going to hear his voice in a moment. I mean, I get what you were saying about Gil, and I don't think I initially fell in love with the sound of his records. I do really like them now. I've grown to really love them, flutes and all.
Yeah.
I love Brian Jackson's kind of musical settings, yeah. And I really recognise that Gil, despite the rather sad and tragic way his life ended, or the last years of his life, was a figure of almost, you know, forbidding intelligence.
No, I mean, going directly to this interview, he talks about, well, first of all, in terms of what you're talking about, Brian Jackson, he talks quite extensively about the process of working with Brian. And Brian Jackson himself is in the interview as well. He speaks.
Yes.
And that's really interesting because as a songwriting duo, Brian Jackson writing the tunes, Gil writing the words.
But then
Gil really talks about, well, he met Langston Hughes, the great writer, yes, Langston Hughes, who really sort of encouraged him and introduced him to the writers of the Harlem Renaissance and so on and so forth. And Gil really kind of has this sense of himself being a part of this continuum of black intelligentsia.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, and of course, he wrote a novel before he ever recorded an album. He wrote the novel The Vulture, and he was a poet when he was still, you know, an adolescent. So he really was a literary figure, you know, and I think his music is very literary, you know. So even the sort of the non-political songs, of which of course there are many, I mean, something like Pieces of a Man is just kind of deeply moving. Regardless of race or skin colour, it's just a beautiful song about being a human male.
I think a lot of this stuff makes, as you say, his rather desperate final years all the more perplexing. Mm. You know, if you're going to ask me, you name an artist who's going to develop a serious drug problem, I wouldn't have named Gil Scott-Heron.
No.
You know,
because we make songs like The Bottle. I mean, exactly. He wrote about addiction. He wrote about alcoholism.
But, I mean, let's play a first clip. He's talking about how the American Constitution is essentially a fraudulent document insofar as that America doesn't live up to its own promises.
Its own advanced publicity, as he says.
Yeah.
Very
That's
funny.
Classic,
comment.
Gil.
Yeah.
Brilliant.
Using primarily the Constitution of the United States as the basis of where I'm coming from, which indicates that there should be justice, liberty, and equality for each and every individual American citizen, we try to focus the attention of the people on the inequities that exist within that document. And the thing that we'd most like to do is make America live up to all of its advanced publicity in terms of in terms of it actually becoming the democracy and the society of the multiracial society that it has always boasted to the world about.
And now it's a winter. Winter in America.
And he's right, as we are seeing on the streets of America right here and now.
Yeah.
The interview's by Cliff White, by the way. It's 1976, February 76.
Yeah, the album called It's Your World that's just come out, which has some live stuff, has a live version of The Bottle on it, for example.
That's right. And he's in England. He's playing shows. He's playing a show that night, which we've also got the review of the show by Vivian Goldman on our
site. Oh, in Colchester, Essex University. Hotbed of 70s lefties. Hotbed of 70s.
But, you know, he's endlessly articulate and interesting.
It's a wonderful, it's a great interview. And also the timing of it is really interesting as well, 76. He's made all that music in the early 70s and really developing his voice on that stage, I think, is really interesting to hear him talk about it.
Sure. We can listen to another clip, because as I said, that he's kind of, Cliff White raises this quite interesting thing as he, Cliff, and to some extent rightly, feels that people like Langston Hughes and writers like that are better known and appreciated away from the United States of America, and that black kids themselves aren't aware of their own literary history, at least not nearly as much as, maybe that's changed now, but certainly in 1976, probably a very good case for this. And Gill simply says, well, that's because they don't get any recognition in the United States of America that black artists, whether, you know, well, let's listen to the clip, because he says it much better than I'm saying it.
Take it away, Gill.
As black people don't have the proper forums often to display our artists and our people of that nature. And we have to therefore be dependent on the society at large to provide these forums, and they're often more anxious to show Elvis Presley than Chuck Berry.
Right, I hear that.
And
yeah, right.
Tom Jones than Little Richard, yeah. And the Osmonds than the Jacksons, and it's constantly been a sort of an issue.
And we were almost lost Detroit this time.
Yeah, you know, I mean, can't really add a lot to that. No, I mean, it's great stuff. I mean, it's mad stuff in this interview. They talk about the Cod War between the UK and Norway at one point in it, which is sort of a slightly mad moment. He's passionate about education. In fact, that's kind of what he's talking about in that clip as well, is he's got this line, which is, you've got to educate before you can become active. You've got to know, you've got to have correct information. And his thing is, how do you get the correct information through to people? And I think in this era of fake news, however one uses that term, I think he's almost more correct now than maybe he was then.
Mm. I think it's been interesting to see the proliferation of resources, just even in the last week or so, with people actually wanting to get more educated about these issues in the face of what's happening at the moment. There's been a lot of really good resources that have been made available online, you know, reading lists and videos for people who maybe would like to know more and would like to get better educated, but aren't usually provided with those resources, say in their schooling or wherever else. But so people with that knowledge and expertise have been putting together some fantastic resources as well, which I think has been really positive. It's been a really positive thing to come out of everything that's going on.
Sure.
Yeah. I mean, Gill was a fascinating guy. I saw him perform a couple of times in the 80s. He did enjoy a slight kind of revival of interest in his work in the mid 80s. I mean, he wrote songs about, ironically, about Washington, D.C.
Yeah.
Didn't he? There were famous songs about Washington. And
it's the nation's capital.
Yeah. Washington, I think I saw it at Brixton Academy.
Right.
You know, he was pretty great. I have to say, I do think he's a sort of towering figure. And nowhere less than on that kind of the last record that he made with Richard Russell, you know, I'm New Here, which is just an extraordinary album with sort of electronic backing, and Gill more or less just monologuing over the top and reminiscing about his childhood and the women who brought him up. It's an extraordinary kind of parting shot.
Yeah,
that do you know the record?
I do. The process of making it was very, very difficult as well.
I think it probably was. I mean, this is a guy who ended up essentially a crack addict.
Oh, he was
virtually on the streets, destitute, and I mean, it's an awful kind of parable, and I just don't know. But the records stand up so well, you know, the famous pieces like The Revolution Will Not Be Televised, Whitey on the Moon, so many extraordinary kind of
Johannesburg,
you know, musical poems. Yeah, Johannesburg, you know. I found myself kind of listening to this audio and thinking, well, I mean, I wonder what somebody like Gil would think about this moment in time and what Nina Simone would have made of it. I mean, is it different? Is it going to change anything? How do you guys see this unfolding? And do you see musicians continuing to play an important role in giving voice to the rage and frustration?
That presupposes that they always have. And I think that, as I said earlier, that I think actually the musician's role in giving voice to the rage and frustration has been always an occasional and temporary thing. That will continue. I don't see any change happening in RE. You know, I just don't. I'm sorry, I've become a cynical fucking mouth. You know, that you can have the worst president in virtually, well, I wouldn't say the history of the Union. There'd be some pretty bad presidents in the 19th century.
Certainly the first worst we've ever known, by a long, long chalk.
You know, and that's up against the likes of Richard Nixon, you know. I mean, the
and
bar
George
was...
W. Bush. And George W. Yeah, exactly. I was about to say.
Yeah, but the bar was set pretty low in the first place, you know. And the thing is that most Western societies, not just America, but European societies, are institutionally and inherently racist. I just don't think you can deny that. And just a single set of events is not going to change that. And indeed, the things which make life difficult for people, all people, black and white, which is economics and so on and so forth, and societal problems, when life gets worse, people tend to lock the door of their fortresses behind them, you know?
I think one of the heartbreaking things about these protests in the time of this pandemic is that the pandemic already was affecting adversely the worst off, which in many cases is the black community. And it's this horrible, bitter kind of situation where the pandemic will actually make it harder to achieve change because of exactly what you're saying, Mark. People are already worse off, and that will make things harder to change, politically speaking, because of that locking doors behind kind of attitude.
To be specific about America, yes, the North, the Union, won the Civil War. They lost Reconstruction. But the disaster of the failure of Reconstruction immediately after the Civil War means that actually, A, the Civil War has never really ended, and B, that the inequalities between the races have, in some respects, remained very much the same without the construct of slavery. The division between the races in America, whether in rural America or urban America, are as stark now as they ever were. You know, I'm sorry, I don't see any changes happening.
Well, I think in some respects things are changing, but slowly. And I think that it's important to, you know, hope for change and agitate for and work towards change.
I think things are getting worse. You now have the Supreme Court, which is the most conservative Supreme Court we've had for pretty much 50 years.
Yeah, I mean, I think things have got worse, certainly, under
and also Trump has filled the judiciary below the Supreme Court level with right-wing judges. And now you've got judges helping Republican parties in various parts of the country obstruct voting amongst minorities and so on and so forth. There's all kinds of gerrymandering politically going on. You know, I'm sorry, I think things are getting worse.
No, I think you're right, certainly on the legislative front and in terms of we're going backwards. I think where things hopefully will improve is in terms of the education on a more grassroots level. One can only hope that will change partly as a result of these protests.
You can't lose faith in that. I agree with you, Jasper. I mean, even though as long as Trump is in power, things can only get worse. But I think Jasper is right that you cannot go to complete despair.
I don't know about that. I'm sorry.
Well, but then it becomes almost self-fulfilling, doesn't it? I think we have to band together and work towards the right kind of change.
Yeah, I think it's also, and do the work, essentially, is one of the key things, is that it's well and good saying, you know, describing how things are bad and being avowedly against it, but also doing things that uplift people in actual terms, whether that's donating, whether that's educating, whether that's supporting black artists, black musicians, all of that together, you have to do that.
Fight the power! Fight the power! Fight the power! Fight the power! Fight the power!
talk a little bit about Nina Simone, maybe Public Enemy. I just wanted to pull out a quote from a piece by Michael Gonzalez that we have on RBP that he wrote for Wax Poetics.
Who's a great writer, I think.
Yeah. You know, he says he wasn't a sort of dyed-in-the-wool Nina fan, didn't know that much about her till she received an award, and he was at the award ceremony and he talked to her. But there's a quote in this piece where she talks about writing Mississippi Goddam. She says, "All the truths that I had denied to myself for so long rose up and slapped me in the face. The 1963 bombing of the little girls in Alabama and the murder of Medgar Evers were like the final pieces of a jigsaw that made no sense until you fitted the whole thing together. I suddenly realized what it was to be black in America in 1963. But it wasn't an intellectual connection of the type Lorraine Hansberry had been repeating to me over and over. It came as a rush of fury, hatred, and determination." So Lorraine Hansberry, who wrote A Raisin in the Sun. So the piece talks about key figures like James Baldwin. You'd mentioned Gil and Langston Hughes. So Langston Hughes gets a mention here. James Baldwin, who was a friend of Nina's. Leroy Jones. You know, key figures in black literary life in America. But I like that quote because it's just that moment where Nina kind of lost it.
Yeah.
Fury, hatred, and determination. And, you know, she was a very angry woman. And some of that stuff was personal, but she was utterly fearless. You know, in her prime, the songs she wrote, she really was one of the figureheads of rage and resistance, and so important. You know, again, you know, the way she ended her life, bitter and alcoholic, but she did such incredibly important work, I think.
Yeah, made incredible music, and through that music, I think, has and does continue to inspire people. It's very emotional music, and it's touching and powerful, I think.
I think one interesting thing you kind of raised there, Barney, about both what happened to Gil and what happened to Nina, is that it's hard to be an artist of colour in America. It's just hard, you know, that... Yeah, sure, maybe you can make a lot of money. Maybe you can do this and you can do that. Yes. But the kind of pressures, both from outside and from within your own community, that comes to them, you know, it's just hard.
Alabama's got me so upset. Tennessee made me lose my rest. And everybody knows about Mississippi. Goddamn. Can't you see it? Can't you feel it? It's all in the air. I can't stand the pressure much longer. Somebody say a prayer.
Let's touch on Public Enemy, because this is a piece by Kodwo Eshun from ID magazine. And this is August 1992, so not long after the LA riots that had been provoked, ignited by the beating of Rodney King. So this is Chuck D. You know, he's answering questions about the track Burn Hollywood Burn, which almost prefigured the riots, which was on Fear of a Black Planet. Chuck sort of says, it's like a match on a pool of gasoline. It's like, I told you so. You know, it's almost as if he knew what was about to happen.
Sure.
It's just an interesting interview with Chuck D, who, you know, like the other figures we've mentioned, was an extraordinarily articulate black musical figure.
Yeah.
And in the context of hip hop, was the guy who channeled Public Enemy into being a voice of a lot more than just gangster kind of aesthetics. You know, Public Enemy were militantly rhetorical in their denunciations of the systemic racism that we've talked about. What was your first awareness of Public Enemy and Chuck D?
I remember I was in my old band's management office, and he put on Don't Believe the Hype. And I have to say, I hated it when I first heard it. But in very much the same way as I hated Jimi Hendrix doing Purple Haze when I first heard it. It sounded riotous and chaotic and amusical. And then maybe, 2 months later, this massive light bulb comes on. And it's actually, I suddenly realised it's one of the best things I'd heard in like 20 years. Mm. You know, that good. Mm. Sonically that good. I mean, just Hank Shockley, the bomb squad, that sort of, that amazing soundscape, which just sounded like a police raid. We're talking about all this stuff. It sounds like you're in the middle of a police raid. There's sirens going off, you know, and those amazing, amazing songs and both that combination of Chuck D's kind of visceral, tough rapping and Flavor Flav doing this kind of mad shit of, you know,
jesterish kind of stuff. Going
absolutely.
On. Yeah.
I mean, sure. So my first response was really negative. I just thought it was so ugly. And then when I got it, oh boy, I got it. I'd say it's some of the best stuff that's come out in the last 40 years.
Mm. Codwo, who is a black writer, notes in this piece, he says, what happened to Rodney King was so normal that most rappers played their responses very cool. Anyone who shouted it up as a scandal fell into the trap of making it seem exceptional.
Yeah.
I think it's quite an insight. Let's not forget, of course, the Public Enemy logo showed, was it a black man, a black panther in the crosshairs of a gun? That's pretty timely to remember that.
Burn, Hollywood, burn. I smell a riot going on. First they're guilty, now they're gone. Yeah, I'll check out a movie, but it'll take a black one to move me. Get me the hell away from this TV. All this news and views are beneath me. So all I hear about is shots ringing out about gang putting each other's head out. So I'd rather kick some slang out.
The last of the pieces we're featuring in the kind of free main feature is Dorian Lynskey talking to Kendrick Lamar in 2015.
Someone I was going to bring up earlier when you asked Mark about whether the music still plays a role, I think Kendrick Lamar is one of those people who today is still making very politically charged and politically powerful music that's in lots of ways speaking to a new generation of young music fans and music listeners in general, because he's managed to both break the mainstream while remaining political and making pretty radical records. I mean, I think To Pimp a Butterfly, which is what this piece is mostly about, is an incredible record. It's one of my favourite records of
the last stunning album.
10 years, if not, you know, ever. And it's just, it manages to combine all these disparate strands of jazz and hip-hop and soul and funk together with a very, very political stance. I mean, at the end of each song, more and more of him having a sort of staged conversation with Tupac where he's asking questions of Tupac. Obviously, you know, this is a previously recorded interview, but that dialogue that he builds throughout the album is incredibly powerful, and it shows just how much he's looking back and trying to build on this sentiment that we've been talking about that's built throughout a history of outspoken and powerful political musicians.
I mean, I'll read just a bit of Dorian from this piece. One reason that To Pimp a Butterfly has resonated so powerfully is timing. This is 5 years ago, June 2015. Its complex reflections on identity and racism landed in the wake of the Black Lives Matter movement and a string of cases in which unarmed black men died at the hands of the police. And D'Angelo is quoted as saying, the timing of both, I assume he means Black Lives Matter and To Pimp a Butterfly. The timing of both was kind of uncanny. It was almost a sign. Motherfuckers are making some shit that's relevant to the times. 5 years ago.
Yep.
It is an extraordinary record. And Kendrick talks about Trayvon Martin, which was the latest, probably most notorious shooting of an unarmed black youth. That had only recently happened, I think. Kendrick says, these are issues that if you come from that environment, it's inevitable to speak on. It's already in your blood because I am Trayvon Martin, you know. I am all these kids. It's already implanted in your brain to come out of your mouth just as soon as you've seen it on the TV.
Yeah, I remember it's very interesting. You know, Gary Young, the Guardian columnist.
The great Gary Young, yeah.
Great Gary Young. He was living in America with his family and he made the decision to come back to England, even though professionally it was may have harmed him, I don't know, but because he didn't feel his kids were going to be safe anymore in America.
Yeah.
And that's a pretty terrifying thing, you know, if you don't feel your children are safe.
No, completely.
You hate my people, your plan is to terminate my culture. You're fucking evil, I want you to recognize that I'm a proud monkey. You vandalize my perception, but can't take down from it. This is more than confession. I mean, I might press the button just so you know my discretion. I'm caught in my feelings. I know that you feel it. You sabotage my community, making the killing. You made me a killer. Emancipation of a real nigga.
One more piece just to mention among the three offerings, which is, I mean, it's actually, it's almost funny, you know, to sort of strike a slightly lighter note, but it's still very relevant. It's Vernon Gibbs, who's our featured writer. A rare example of, as I said earlier, a black rock critic, quote unquote, writing for magazines like Crawdaddy and so forth in the 70s. I mean, he was writing, I think he was at Columbia, Mark. I mean, I think you know more about the... So
yes,
he was at Columbia
yes.
University, and he started writing for the Columbia Daily Spectator. And one of the pieces he wrote for the Spectator was just an account of kind of hanging with James Brown in, I guess, the early spring of 71. And it's just... it's really sort of fascinating because he's sitting there talking to James, and this kind of really annoying white guy interrupts them and wants to come in because he's trying to do a movie deal with the Godfather of Soul. And James Brown is sitting there obviously talking to a young black man.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
James deals with him very, very coolly indeed.
Yes, I really loved that piece. I was so pleased to find it. And it's interesting also because I've read a lot of interviews with James Brown, almost all undertaken by white people. And there's a noticeably different tone to James Brown in this interview, talking to Vernon. It's slightly warmer. It's slightly less sort of finger wagging, which James kind of tended to do. I really love this piece. I mean, it's also, it's James Brown's a great moment in his career. This is what's...
71.
71. You know, I mean, he is actually at the top of his game in 1971.
Yeah.
Producing some of the funkiest music in history.
Yeah,
at
he's
that
like the president
moment.
Of funk, really. At this
Absolutely.
Point, isn't he? And, I mean, look, James Brown was never Gil Scott-Heron.
No.
But he was a very, very powerful symbol of black pride. And if anyone was sort of was the black president, it was probably him. There is a quote that I just quickly read out from this, which is James talking to Vernon. He says, "Whether I'm a legend or not is up to you to decide. You are a young black, and you know what I stand for. I do feel a certain responsibility, first to myself as a man, and I think if I just exercise that, it will serve as such a tremendous force to revolution, to identity, respect, and dignity, and pride to the black man." So that's where he's coming from in 71.
I mean, you know, it's got to remember that James always saw achievement in very strictly sort of free market capitalistic terms.
Yes.
It's about black people owning their own businesses and all that, which is great, which is all, but that's the only terms he saw it in. You know, he wasn't a sort of a left political figure at all.
Absolutely
not.
And he went to, he dropped in to see Tricky Dicky, didn't he? And I think
he did.
You know, he accommodated Republican politics, and he's a problematic figure. He was a close to sociopathic kind of bully and tyrant. A lot of people who work with James Brown don't have very happy tales to tell. But it is interesting where he also says black people have got to be able to go every place, any place they want. By the time my kids come up, I want them to be able to become president if they want it.
Yeah. No, it's a great piece.
Yeah, it is a great piece.
About a person who I still find fascinating, if slightly repellent.
We are. I mean, look, Mark, kudos to you for getting Vernon Gibbs on board. I mean, I think it's one of the things that made me happiest when he came on board. He's written some terrific pieces.
Yeah.
Even the last piece we chose by him, which I just mentioned briefly, is a piece about two hip-hop indie labels, Sleeping Bag Records and Next Plateau Records.
Uh-huh.
And it's just a very nicely constructed and written piece about hip-hop in the late 80s. It's 1988. It was a piece written for Billboard, funnily enough.
Yeah.
Sleeping
Bag, very interesting.
Yes.
Particularly a very interesting label. I mean, not a hip-hop label, but also Arthur Russell was part of it, which is extraordinary in itself. But,
very cool label.
Yeah, it's great stuff. No, and Vernon's a real stylist as a writer as well. You know, it's not just, you know, the fact he actually writes really beautifully. So
terrific. Well, look, great to talk with you about all of that at this very alarming moment in time. Every day sort of reveals new developments. So, Mark, we've covered Gil Scott-Heron, the audio, we've covered the three pieces, and I think probably now is time to talk about some of the new pieces for subscribers that have gone into the library this week. So why don't you kick us off?
Well, and in complete contrast to the previous 50 minutes of conversation, we start again. It's our new edition, Philip Elwood, for the San Francisco Examiner. 1965, he went to see Judy Garland play in a sort of smart supper club in San Francisco.
Which is actually, that's actually, just to jump in, really, it's really funny because there's that great Richard Pryor quote where he said, white people had Judy Garland, we had Nina, about Nina Simone. That's a funny contrast.
Absolutely.
Well, Elwood says, although Miss Garland looked fine, she was not singing at all well, and the audience knew it. Her pitch wobbled, and the cracking voice, in the past an occasionally attractive mannerism, was a sign of strain, not staging. It's a pretty bad refusing. Judy's soon husband-to-be is kind of like walks up onto the stage with her, and then they're sat in the front row, and she keeps talking to him and so on. And she died a couple of years later, so this is kind of, you know, Judy coming unraveled. It's great, though. Now, the next piece is really interesting. About 3 weeks ago, we had this interview by Jamie McCluskey III, a.k.a. Nicky Wine for KRLA Beat, with Brian Wilson, and that was in 65, and he's talking about the music. Now, this is from June 66, basically a year later, and he's become obsessed with toys. And it says, then there is the cop car, which Brian was delighted with until the battery fell out. When I asked the chief Beach Boy just why he had purchased a police car, he explained that he felt that it was protecting him in some way. I'll never have to worry about being protected by the police because I'll have my own police car. And actually, it's quite interesting because this could be the Brian Wilson who is starting to come slightly unglued. She's writing it up as very funny that he's kind of toys. But this is the guy who's about to put a sandbox into his living room to put his piano in so he can be in the sand. You know?
I mean, it's June 66, so, yeah, unequivocally, Brian was starting to come unglued. I mean, he first dropped acid a year before this.
Right.
So, you know, mentally probably becoming slightly unraveled, even though he's at work on Pet Sounds and stuff. The Pet Sounds at this house at this point, or is it...
I'd say he'd be after. This be getting towards working on Smile.
Really
Smart,
moving
Smile,
into the Smile era. I can't remember the release date, but I would say yeah. I mean, you know, Brian's already unraveling a little bit.
Yeah, and so this is a jokey piece because she takes it as face value. It's all about toys, but in fact, with knowing what we know now, you read into it all this other stuff.
He does talk about it was a fantasy of childhood, trying to relive with these toys. It's sort of like that points to something a bit deeper than it just being oh, haha, look, toys.
That's right, and I think dear old Nicky Wine, aka Jamie McCluskey, doesn't really quite get what's going on, you know. But anyway, 1973, New Musical Express. This is a very rare item. Roy Carr interview with the great Professor Longhair, the titan of New Orleans piano, who had basically been out of the game for a long time because he never got paid. Yeah. He was a man who's just ripped off left, right, and center. He says, I was one of the unlucky ones, and this is one reason why I quit playing 15 years ago. I just wasn't getting paid. He says in the interview that all the people who, you know, when he talks about a lot of people taking his style, and he doesn't mind it. He says, those guys, they didn't steal nothing. I taught them a lot, so I really didn't mind them using it. I wanted it to spread.
Yeah.
But he says in the interview that basically Mac Rebennack and one other person were the only people who came and visited him when he was on his uppers. You know, all the other people who'd taken so much from him just walked away from him entirely.
Yes.
Which is real sad.
Yes.
Very sad.
Michael Goldberg, San Francisco Chronicle, 1981, interviewing Suicide, Martin Rev. Barney, you're a Suicide fan, aren't you? Up to a point.
I love Suicide. Yeah. You know, they were one of my favourite sort of quote-unquote punk groups. And in great part because, you know, they weren't an obvious punk group. No guitars, just these cheap synthesizers. And this kind of slightly psychotic frontman, the great Alan Vega. I mean, the first album, I probably played the first Suicide album I definitely played the first Suicide album a lot more than I played Never Mind the Bollocks or the first Clash album. I
mean, absolutely.
It still means more to me musically. I love everything about their sort of minimalist, kind of brutal sort of urban approach to sort of urban psychosis. I thought they were extraordinary.
Absolutely. I mean, this is a really interesting interview. Martin Rev says, coming out with a group that had no real context, no real ties to anything traditional or anything that was going on at the time, either in the amount and kind of instruments we had, in the kind of music, in the kind of theatre, in the kind of lyrics. In a way, it was like pure suicide to try and take that and turn it into something that would work. Yeah. He's kind of explaining why they called the band Suicide. Also, this is just off the back of their that tour with Clash and be basically bottled off stage just about every night.
Yes.
And he says, in some ways, it was getting a return on what we'd set up. We were baiting audiences for years. Then all of a sudden, audiences are baiting us.
Yes. Yeah.
Ghost Rider, motorcycle hero. 1989, The Times, this is David Toop's obituary of Larry Parnes, extraordinary manager, the guy who renamed his stars Wild and Fury and Eager and all those other names that he did. One line is great. He says, in the 1950s, nobody was named Kylie, Jason or Lee. Everybody was Jack, Reg, Norman and Joyce. Which is absolutely spot on. You know, you had to rename them. Yeah. And he said, Parnes took the idea further with his subsequent clients, the initial client being Marty Wilde, I think, advising them in the development of new identities, shimmering sexual images, which were all grease and paraffin wax and metallic fabrics. The contrast against the drab majority of boys and girls who made up their audience, the children who had grown up with food and clothes rationing, was sharp enough to provoke a collective ache of wonderment and desire. It's great. It's a really, really
I love
really
the name good. Vince Eager. It reminded me of, we were talking about Georgie Fame, also renamed by Parnes.
Yeah.
Vince Eager, or perhaps Georgie Not Too Eager, as we learn from Georgie Fame's accounts of fending the attentions of Larry Parnes off.
It has to be said that Marty Wilde, who David quotes in this article, remembers him very fondly.
Sure.
Isn't someone who's going to, like, you know, stab the guy in the back after, you know, they'd long ceased having any professional connection. So Marty Wilde's very generous about him, which is kind of good to...
One of the great pop Svengalis, you know, however sort of morally questionable some of his practices were, you know, an unavoidable figure in the history of British pop.
Yeah. 1993, a really big William Shaw interview with Depeche Mode. It's more like a special feature. He hangs out with them for a few days. A terrific writer, William Shaw. This is for Details magazine. And basically, he talks mostly to Messrs. Gore, Martin Gore and Dave Gahan. Martin Gore's kind of an interesting guy because he took over the songwriting after Vince Clarke left and really sort of determined what that act was to become.
And brought the perviness into Depeche Mode.
Exactly.
He says, the piece talk about pervy synth pop? Yes.
Quite significant amounts of perv get
sorted. Because he was quite... I mean, there's nothing... This isn't so derogatory. He made an art form of perviness, didn't he?
And he really got into kind of going to things like the Torture Garden and clubs like that. You know, I mean, that was his thing.
Is that where you saw him?
ooh. Not the night I was down there, as he said.
What fetish clubs did you generally frequent then?
That was the only one I've ever frequented. And you couldn't really say going there once is frequenting. I genuinely went down there once. I found it slightly unnerving.
I was sort of joking, and now it turns out to have actually happened.
Yeah?
Right, go on, let's move swiftly on.
No, you got a problem with this, Barney?
No, not whatsoever. I'll see you down there on Saturday.
So anyway, so Martin Gore says, I should imagine from reading the lyrics, they'd think I was dark and moody with quite a perverted sense of things. So half this piece is basically about Martin Gore and what makes up Martin Gore, particularly as a writer. And the other half is about David Gahan as the rock and roll frontman, as he metamorphosed from that clean-cut young man in the early days on Top of the Pops.
The boy from Basildon
to the guy with, like, tattoos and hair and beard and naked chest, and actually, as it turned out, a very serious drug addict. Yeah. He's claiming in this piece that he's clean. In fact, he was on the way down rather than the way up at this point. He talks about the band, about him becoming difficult. He says, a lot of the time, it's hard for them to even want to be in the same room as me, which is kind of interesting. He says, I was drinking way too much. But then I think most people do when they get to that age. A little drink turned into a big one. Well, what he doesn't mention is he's already well on his way into a heroin habit at the time this interview took place.
Yeah.
And last piece, very, very briefly. Just great to get it. An interview, well, it's a profile with a bit of an interview with the marvellous smooth blues singer Charles Brown by R.J. Smith for LA Weekly in 97. And, you know, he's talking about his sartorial standards. The people in the street, a lot of the guys go for jeans. I say, look, people don't pay to see you do that. Charles Brown is a really interesting guy. I mean, I read Anthony Helbert's really wonderful series of essays, which is basically about homosexuality and black music, principally. And he says that Charles Brown was a major part of that slightly off Central Avenue scene in the 40s and 50s, where there were a lot of gay clubs, a lot of drag acts. Yeah. We forget that was a big part of black urban culture, which is pretty much gone.
And really, you know, accepted within the black community as well. It wasn't what they weren't out. They weren't sort of ostracized in any way. I think
absolutely.
Like, yeah.
Charles Brown was almost certainly gay himself. I don't think he ever was out.
I don't think he ever came out, but I think that's generally accepted, isn't it?
I've always loved his stuff. I first heard Charles Brown probably about in the mid 70s when I was really getting into sort of jump blues and all that. And whilst he wasn't a jump blues musician, being part of that Central Avenue scene, he's very close to Nat King Cole. Yes. I mean, early Nat King Cole and Charles Brown, they even basically shared musicians, is that the two brothers, Oscar Moore and Johnny Moore. Johnny Moore was Three Blazers,
yes.
Oscar Moore, and one of them played with
Nat
Charles. Cole.
No, there's no doubt, Nat King Cole, it didn't hide the fact that he'd been influenced by Charles Brown. Very, I mean, people don't talk
and Ray
about...
Charles as well.
Ray Charles as well, for sure. And
so I'm very pleased to get that in.
Yeah, absolutely, great, that's excellent.
Black night is falling. Oh, I hate to be alone.
That's my lot.
Okay, lovely. I'll hand over to you in 2 seconds, Jas, but I just wanted to briefly mention an interview with Harry Belafonte, just because it ties in with the main theme of the episode. Belafonte talking in 2011, and just looking back through his career, really, and being asked about... So, I mean, Belafonte, you know, was quite a mainstream figure, wasn't he, Mark? You know, he really brought Calypso to the States and was sort of the acceptable face of black entertainment in a way.
Being very, very political. I mean,
exactly. He did more than his fair share for civil rights in the 60s. I mean, and he talks about... It's an interesting thing. I mean, it sounds slightly defensive, but he says, you know, I stood on stage in America, a country divided by race, and sang a song, a love song, opposite a white woman.
Yeah.
You know, I worked the Waldorf Astoria and other places where no black man had ever stood before. Those were all political statements as important as the songs that some people thought I should be singing. So, you know, I mean, there's a hint of sort of defensiveness and justification in there, but no one can dispute that Belafonte, you know, was a really important and iconic figure in the civil rights era.
You know, do I love what he did? No, I don't. Do I admire him? I admire him tremendously, you know, and it was risky stuff to do at that time.
Yeah. Yes, absolutely. Because there were a lot of black entertainers who were like, don't rock the boat. You know, I won't get to play the Waldorf Astoria if I speak out, you know.
Like Sammy Davis Jr. to some extent and others.
You know?
I mean, to be fair, Sammy Davis
did his bit, I think, you know. And it certainly was very important when he was welcomed into that Rat Pack. Whatever you think of Sinatra and Dean Martin and so forth, the fact that Sammy Davis became part of that little gang, as sort of macho and posturing as they were, you know, I think was an important moment in American culture.
Yep.
Jasper, over to you.
I just want to mention a few pieces quickly. The first of which
I hope
is
you're going to talk about
That's what I was about to say. It was a review of Peaches' album Impeach My Bush by Stephen Dalton in the Times from the 7th of July 2006, which is,
God,
I mean,
lover.
A, I, it has some great moments as an album. I was listening to it yesterday, and it's some of it is really very funny, very rude. You know, I mean, the opening track, "Fuck or Kill," bluntly champions erotic freedom over state-sponsored slaughter. So, you know, she I think is trying to be a bit more political here. A lot of the time, as Stephen Dalton points out, it kind of goes back to risque rhymes and lewd innuendos.
But so,
really?
Something
to, you don't
something,
say.
Something to do with the bush.
Yeah. Yes. I think it's a play on that but, word, Mark. I just...
Possibly.
You know, I don't know why I would say
no,
that.
No, God knows. No, but
The track is quite funny. It goes, "Impeach my bush," and then it blanks out, "Impeach bush." So it's not subtle, but I think it's a valid point. At best, she is funny, inventive, and gloriously filthy. So that's
pretty outrageous, Peaches. I mean, really, ultimately, too outrageous. Whereas there have been other entertainers, and particularly female entertainers, that have been very outrageous. They haven't gone as far as she has, and therefore they've been able to achieve commercial success in a way that she's never come close to.
He says, "Mix the rudest bits of Madonna, Goldfrapp, Pink, Lil Kim, and Princess Superstar, and arguably, you get Peaches."
but a big influence, nonetheless, on people like Lady Gaga.
Oh, yeah.
You know, they all cite
definitely
her, you know, without whom, etc.
I think it's, as I said, a decent album. I'd recommend going and listening to it. It's got some good moments on it. And topical as well, impeaching people.
Face it, we all want tush. If I'm wrong, impeach my bush. Impeach my bush. Impeach my bush. Impeach my bush. Impeach bush. Impeach bush.
Next up, Alicia Keys in London in 2010. Caroline Sullivan goes to see her for The Guardian. And this is a point where she's made Empire State of Mind with Jay-Z, obviously mega hit, so that's kind of elevated her. And Caroline Sullivan points out that it's elevated her to a point where in her stage shows, it will no longer do to merely traipse on stage and sing. The New York R&B singer is accordingly wheeled into public view in a cage within which the leather-clad Keys writhes until the bars magically give way. So it's got a bit of sort of stage show about
it. I'm struggling to imagine that, because there's something really rather prissy about Alicia Keys.
She's famously clean living. I mean, she doesn't, you know, she doesn't...
Writhing in a cage.
Doesn't fit with her image.
No.
For this famously clean living singer, this must have counted as unbridled smut. Which is quite a funny idea. But Caroline Sullivan makes the point that ultimately the show, even despite all that stuff, despite the cage, the leather and some lumpy dancing, plus a slick show-off backing band, Keys' heart is in the music, not the showbiz. She's a classically trained pianist and, you know, she writes very traditionally singer-songwriter, piano, songs, and she's a good pianist. And I think that ends up coming through on the night, and Caroline Sullivan rather enjoys the show.
Let's say she bores the arse off me.
She's not my favourite musician, but you know, such is. Nene Cherry in 2014, for re-emerging as a solo artist after quite a long time. And it's an album called Blank Project that Rob Young reviews in The Wire. And it's an interesting short review. And actually the album itself, if neither of you have listened to it, I would recommend it. It's really interesting. Barney, what might pique your interest is that there's a duet with Swedish robo chanteuse Robin on the album. So that's a good track. And it's a kind of introspective, emotional album where she's kind of trying to make a start again in terms of a solo career after a long time not making music. And I think she's made some really great music.
Right, so Mark and I both are Nena fans. Loved her, you know, fantastic first album back in the 80s.
Absolutely.
She was cool.
Also, by all accounts, a fairly decent sort.
I met her, funnily enough, I would have said probably around this time, Jasper, 2014, I went to some kind of music conference in Oslo and I was introduced to her. She was so lovely. No kind of airs and graces, just perfectly natural, friendly person who had no, like, I'm Nena Cherry attitude at all. So I can say my gut instincts about her was that she was a thoroughly nice person. And that's what I gather she is, you know, that's what I've heard.
Great. Super. Mm. Lastly, a long interview with Sananda Maitreya formerly known as Terence Trent D'Arby.
Oh, for fuck's sake. What's he called these days?
Sananda Maitreya. And it's Paul Lester speaks to him in The Guardian, and it goes as far as he refers to Terence Trent D'Arby as he, not I, as though he's talking about a different person.
Yeah.
And it's a really interesting interview where he talks about it was becoming Sananda Maitreya or death. You know, he feels like that Terence Trent D'Arby kind of died in some sort of cosmic sense. And it's a fascinating interview. It's very long. You get a slight picture of Sananda Maitreya being quite a struggling individual with a lot of the things that kind of happened to him in the wake of his mass fame. Yeah. But he's made a lot of music since then still. I have to confess, I've not listened to any of it. I do really like Introducing the Hardline according to Terence Trent D'Arby. I think it's a pretty cool record.
Oh, it's a fantastic record. Well, it does some fantastic stuff on it. I mean, I remember when he first emerged, and he was on The Tube. It was actually almost the making of him. He did this appearance on the TV show The Tube and was just dynamite. Yeah. And like, boom, If You Let Me Stay, which is a single he was promoting at the time off that album. I just love that record. You know, I just thought, this guy is just going to be great. And then I was working with Pete Wingfield, one of our writers, record producer, 18 with a Bullet, and so on and so forth. And he played keyboards on the subsequent album, second album. He said it was the most chaotic session he'd ever been to. But basically, Terence had decided to produce himself. Mm. And the thing was just a complete fiasco.
Yeah, it was neither fish nor fowl, I think.
That's right. It was the aptly titled.
I interviewed Terence when that first album came out. And, you know, at that point, you thought this guy is going to become a superstar. He's going to become like the biggest thing in kind of neo soul, you know, and had like three or four big hits off that album. And
great songs.
Where is he now? I mean, it is extraordinary how he chose maybe is the wrong word, but he just opted for something, a much more sort of obscure and eccentric path through his life, you know, to the extent that he's not someone that anyone really talks about today.
I think he's a bit bonkers.
I think there were some mental health issues, there's no doubt, you know. And I know that Paul Lester, who wrote it, is one of those who's kind of stayed very loyal to him and, you know, remembers how interesting he was. And there are interesting things on those subsequent albums. You know, he was trying to do something interesting in a kind of Prince-ish sort of vein and not be an obvious like sort of pop soul hit maker, but unfortunately it's left him a little bit high and dry after all this time, I think.
Yeah, I mean, the album that they're talking about in this interview in 2017 is called Prometheus and Pandora, and quote, is a 53-track smorgasbord of rock, funk, soul, jazz and psych, written, arranged, produced, performed and conceived by Sananda Maitreya.
I'll have to listen.
How many tracks?
53.
Only 53, Mark.
So you laughed earlier when I said I hadn't listened to any of his more recent music.
That's why.
It might take a while. But, you know, I mean, but I think it is interesting. He feels, it comes across in this interview, I mean, he does talk in quite abstruse terms, but he feels that he was pushed out of the music industry by sort of higher powers. And the way he talks about it makes it hard to take him seriously. But there's still, nevertheless, a feeling that he felt that he was pushed. So it's a kind of, in some senses, a sad story, but he seems to still be making music. He still seems to be enjoying himself. So.
He pushed himself out. You know, I mean, honestly, you know, God. But you're right, Barney. I think we all thought he was just going to be such a big star in 1987.
He was an electrifying performer, wasn't he?
Yeah.
With a voice or somewhere between James Brown and Joe Tex. Everyone talked about James Brown. Actually, the sort of timbre of his voice was closer, I think, to Joe Tex. And I love Joe Tex.
Yes.
Skinny legs and all. Skinny legs and all. All right, good. Well, look, I think we probably need to wrap up. Obviously, Jasper, I think we're going to need clips from all 53 of those in the podcast. So if you could get working on those. Otherwise,
I'll do a medley. I'll do a medley of all 53 tracks.
Great. Well, thanks for joining me on what has obviously been a more somber than usual episode of the Rock Back Pages podcast. Sure. We will be back, and thanks for listening. And in the meantime, Mark, talk us out with the last of the Gil Scott-Heron audio clips.
Yeah, this is Gil talking about what he calls the spirit of the drum, about centrality of rhythm to all music and the centrality of the drum.
Okay, bye.
Thanks for listening. Bye-bye.
Well, you know, like, the spirit of the drum has been the motivating force of music for down through the ages, regardless of how much actual credit it's gotten. The drum was the first musical instrument, and it directs all type of movement within music. There's a rhythm, and even when there's no discernible rhythm, that in itself is a rhythm, if you understand what I mean.
That was Gil Scott-Heron in conversation with Cliff White in 1976, concluding this week's Rock's Back Pages podcast. The host were Barney Hoskins and Mark Pringle, and it was co-hosted and produced by Jasper Murison Bowie. The Rock's Back Pages podcast is part of the Pantheon Podcast Network. You can find thousands of articles, as well as hundreds of full-length audio interviews, at rocksbackpages.com. Please take a moment to look at the links in this week's show notes regarding Black Lives Matter protests and consider donating to organizations fighting against racism and injustice.
The revolution will put you in the driver's seat. The revolution will not be televised, will not be televised, will not be televised, will not be televised. The revolution will be no rerun, brothers. The revolution will be live.
Hey, this is Liberty DeVito.
This is Mike Del Judas.
This is Michael Cavanaugh from Broadway's Moving Out.
This is John Jackson, director of the Billy Joel Archive.
This is Russell Javers.
This is Richie Cannata, and you're listening to Glass Houses, a Billy Joel podcast. It's awesome.
I'm Michael Grosvenor.
And I'm Jack Fernino.
We're lifelong Billy Joel fans who launched a podcast in 2020 celebrating the music we love.
Whether you're looking for the greatest hits or the B-sides and rarities, you'll find it all here. And if you've ever wondered what happens behind the scenes of a concert or recording session, we've got you covered.
Join us as we explore albums, tours, band members, the latest news, and more. You'll also get a unique glimpse into the music industry straight from the musicians and other professionals who help make it all happen.
Tune in to Glass Houses, a Billy Joel podcast, at glasshousespod.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
Glass Houses, a Billy Joel podcast, is a proud member of the Pantheon Podcasts Network.